Hi, I'd like to welcome you to the Austrian Circle. This is the program where we talk about the economics of freedom here on WHUS Doors 91.7 FM. So thank you so much for tuning into my show this morning. I'm going to take a little bit of a different route, seeing as this is a new year of 2016. I decided that I'm going to add a little bit more to the show than just economics and politics and philosophy and history and all the wonderful stuff that we've been describing on the show in the past 4 or 5 years that I've been doing the show for. So the expansion is going to be into more along the lines of personal freedom. So a lot of the times on the show, I talk about these really big concepts and societal structures that seem almost impossible to overthrow. One of them is the Federal Reserve, the gigantic, enormous central bank that is the heart of the corrupt financial system, which causes all these terrible incentives when it comes to people taking out loans and banks lending loans and all of this stuff. And what really is any one person or even a large group of individuals to do about something as powerful as the Federal Reserve? I mean, this organization can grant money to anybody who has its favor. And so it can just bail out the government, it can bail out the banks, it can give money to this organization and just print whatever it needs because it doesn't actually have any reserves at all. And so who is going to be able to stand up to such an organization? I mean, Ron Paul has been trying now for a good 30 or 40 years to get people to even pay attention to what the Federal Reserve does, let alone to audit it and to look at its financial backings and see what it's actually been up to, because it's a very secretive organization. And so nobody has been able to make any headway, even Ron Paul, who is a congressperson. And so when we look at these large structures, sometimes we can take away a feeling of hopelessness or desperation that there's not really anything that we can do. And I think a lot about these organizations, politics, the Federal Reserve. I think of them a lot as I would think about the rain. There's not much that I can do about the rain. I can't do a rain dance. It's not anything within my power to change the way that the rain works. I can't make the weather patterns go in a particular direction so that they avoid me and, you know, rain on other people. There's no real way to avoid the politics when it is as far-reaching as an entire country or an entire nation and spans, you know, thousands of miles all across the country. And anything that falls within that spectrum can be controlled and manipulated by said government. There's really not much you can do about it. However, there is a lot that we can do in terms of our personal relationships and our personal behavior that we have direct control over and can show many other people what it is like to be free without having to show it in the societal sense where we change the way that the government works, but rather the way that we hold ourselves and the way that we maintain our behavior and our consistency can really do a lot to show people what freedom actually is without having to completely reorder society. So again, this is something new I'm going to try out. I'm going to pick one of the many topics that I've thought about in terms of personal freedom, talk a little bit about them, and then show how they are immensely consistent with the political ideology of libertarianism. Libertarianism is one of the most consistent and thorough types of ideas and thoughts that I've really come across, and it's one of the things that really drew me to it, is how consistent it is and how universal it is. There's really no exceptions to libertarianism. So as we progress through this series, I'd love to hear your thoughts on it. You can find me online on Facebook at the Austrian Circle. Just do a search for it in the search bar. You'll see a lovely picture of Ludwig von Mises as soon as that search is completed. And please like and post any feedback that you have about this particular concept or any of the shows that I've done over the years. So the first topic I would like to talk about in this strain is called the tyranny of the self. And what I mean by that is that sometimes we can impose preferences onto ourselves that when we really look at ourselves and query our subconscious and really kind of think about what we want in life, what our conscious brain is kind of trying to impose on us is not always in line with what our real preferences of our true self are. And so let's start by kind of defining tyranny. So if you think about a dictator, some guy in a castle who demands things of the people that he has control over, let's say that he wants your food. He comes to your house, knocks on the door and says, you see these guys, the army behind me, we would like to take half of your food every single time that you harvest your food, and we are going to demand that, and if you don't, we will, you know, drag you off, put you in the gallows, whatever it is that they do. And this is tyranny because it is not in line with that person's preferences. So it would be one thing if this king dictator guy walked up to the house, knocked on the door, and said, hey, we're looking for donations. We'd love it if you could give us some grain. You know, every time you harvest some grain, why don't you give us some? And we'll be immensely happy and pleased. And if you say no, that's okay. But, you know, please, we'd really like you to bring us some grain. That would be one thing. But in terms of tyranny, he is saying there will be consequences. I will violently impose my will and my preferences onto you. And your preferences don't matter as much as my preferences, and I need the grain. You will give me the grain, or else, again, there will be massive amounts of consequences and actual physical violence that is carried out against you. So in this way, we can really call tyranny as the supersession or the overriding of someone's preferences and against their will, imposing the preferences of another person or another group onto that person, especially when it comes to their body and their property. So what does this have to do with the tyranny of the self? Well, we can impose our will on ourselves in a myriad of different ways, really. So it might be maybe if I don't go to the gym, then I will not be able to have dessert. I'm not going to give myself dessert that day. Or, you know, some people actually impose it on their body through some form of physical harm, like they'll punch a wall or they will actually harm themselves, cut themselves, something like that. This is a self-destructive behavior. Some of it is for the attention of others, but some of it is to impose their will on themselves and to kind of justify their submission to this tyrannical self that they have up in the top of their head. So the conscious mind is demanding that the subconscious or the rest of the body go along with the mandates of the conscious mind. So let's take an example. Let's say that one day you wake up and you're like, oh, you know, I really would like to go to a mini golf place. I've not done that in years and years and years. I think it would be wonderful for myself and me to go to this place and hit some balls around. It'd be a lot of fun. And then the conscious mind might kick in and start to give us all these excuses. Well, we have to drive all the way over there. Or, oh, well, that's just a kiddie kind of thing. You know, you're just going to be around 8 and 10-year-olds. And, like, why would you want to do something like that? Maybe the conscious mind might start coming up with consequences. If you want to do that, then that means that we can't have dinner tonight. Or we have to stay in the next night because we can't go out two nights in a row. So we start making up all these rules and these legislative decrees for ourselves. And does this start to sound a little bit like what I talk about on the show in terms of the state and in terms of economic strangulation that occurs when the state gets involved with all these laws and regulations and reasons that we have to act in a particular way? Again, this is what the conscious mind is kind of doing when it is lambasting itself and suppressing the true self from asking whether or not we can go and actually act on the preferences that come to mind. Another thing that occurs here is that the conscious mind issues these decrees or mandates not because we want to impose our will on ourselves, but because other people have found it convenient to program ourselves to act on behalf of them. So an example of this would be, let's say that I would really love to go and spend the weekend by myself, go skiing, do all these wonderful things. But I have people in my life who would make me feel guilty if I decided to take a weekend all to myself. So, you know, I have friends that I hang out with that we hang out every weekend. And if we were not to hang out on a particular weekend, they would find that inconvenient because they want me to be there. They have preferences that involve me being there, anything along those lines. So what they might do is cause me to feel guilty about going out and acting on my own preferences. And so then I beat myself up and I say, well, I'm sorry, you know, subconscious, I'd really like to go and go skiing for the weekend. But unfortunately, my friends want me to stay around here, and therefore I'm going to submit to them. Now, this is a little bit of the tyranny of the other person, which is when other people kind of impose their will on us and do all these behaviors to try and manipulate us into doing what they want us to do. These kind of manipulations could be anything from causing us to feel guilty, using eye rolling or like sighing or like things that would generally impose some kind of negativity in the situation, where then I would want to avoid that negativity by giving them the response that they want. So if I say to my friends, hey, I'd really like to go skiing this next upcoming weekend. I'm not going to be able to make it out to the bar to do karaoke with you guys. However, you know, I'll be back the weekend afterwards. And they start sighing and they say, oh, but it's not going to be any fun without you. And oh, why can't you just go to karaoke? It would be so much better if you were there. And what are you going to do up there? There's not going to be any of us up there to keep you company. You can't have any fun without us. You know, all of these kind of things are means by which people can control others and cause them to behave in a way that they would prefer. So you can see here in our discussion that a lot of this really boils down to people's preferences. And being able to control other people's preferences is a dream and a desire of every tyrant that is out there. And these tyrants are not just political tyrants. These are people in our lives. These are ourselves, even in some cases, when we're talking about the tyranny of the self. And so preferences are really the core of this, and preferences have a lot to do with people in terms of political freedom and in terms of libertarianism. So let's say that I have a preference to hire somebody at below the minimum wage, and the person who would otherwise have worked for me at that wage rate has a preference to be employed at that wage rate as opposed to not being employed at all. So in this case, our preferences are completely in line with one another. I have a preference to hire somebody at that wage rate. They have a preference to work at that particular wage rate. We are joined together in our common pursuit of attaining our preferences. Now, of course, the busybody government has to get involved and say, well, I mean, even though your preferences are in line, our preferences are that you don't hire somebody at below that minimum wage because this and that and all of this stuff. But it all boils down to preferences. So whose preferences are more important? In the system that we currently have today, the government's preferences are far more important because they are the ones that are imposed upon everyone else. So in this case, the person who would have otherwise worked at that wage rate, their preferences don't matter. The person who would have hired them at that wage rate, their preferences don't matter. So what happens is the government's preferences are the ones that matter. So earlier on in the show, I contended that universality, consistency, and no exceptions are very important to libertarianism. And in this case, we can see exactly what's going on here. When you have people who are involved, who have preferences that are in line with each other, to override those preferences is inconsistent and not universal. Because then anyone can override anyone else's preferences for whatever subjective arbitrary reason they would like. And that would, of course, be complete chaos and everybody attacking everybody else. And so, you know, the current system has to segment society into the ruling class, which is the political class, and the subservient class, which is the citizens or the serfs. And when the government speaks, everybody else has to listen, but there is no universality here. There's two separate and distinct groups, the law creators, the law imposers, and on the other hand, there are the law followers and the law subservients. So whose preferences are more important? We don't have to worry about this when we don't segregate society into the ruling class and the ruled class. We have a simple horizontal society where if somebody has a preference and that's in line with another person's preference, then they just trade and they can make contracts and they can agree to whatever it is that they'd like. They can say no if they decide that that contract is not what they would like and what they would prefer. But you don't have this other class that can come in and say, well, your preferences don't matter. We are going to impose our preferences whether you like it or not. So I'd like to read you an article by Murray Rothbard here. And it's going to talk a little bit about the court and the justice system, because I can't imagine any other place where this type of imposition of preferences by government over other people is less apparent than with the judiciary and the court systems, especially in this country, but anywhere that you have government-run courts, you are going to get tyranny and imposition of preferences over other people. I don't know if you guys have watched the Making the Murderer show on Netflix, which is an excellent expose on the corruption of the judiciary and the court and police system in this country. And so this article is by Murray and Rothbard. It is called The Tyranny of the Bench. One of the fatal flaws in the concept of limited government is the judiciary, endowed with the compulsory monopoly of the vital power of deciding disputes, of ultimately deciding who can wield force and how much can be wielded. The government judiciary sits as an unchecked and unlimited tyrant, pledged to preside over the rule of law, law that is supposed to apply to every man. The judges themselves are yet above the law and free from its sanctions and limitations. When clothed in the robes of his office, the judge can do no legal wrong and is therefore immune from the law itself. There is a crucial catch-22 in this grisly situation, for if anyone would like to argue against this arrangement, he can do so in our archist system, only before judges who themselves are part of the problem rather than part of the solution. It is up to government judges to rule on whether government judges are immune from the law. How do you think they would decide? Well, how do you think a group of economists would decide on the question of whether economists should be immune, or any other group or profession? Not surprisingly, the United States Supreme Court ruled in 1872 that judges were immune from any damage suits from any judicial acts they had performed, regardless of how wrong, evil, or unconstitutional those acts may have been. When clothed in judicial authority, judges can do no wrong, period. Recently, a case of an errant judge has come up again because his action as a judge was considered generally to be monstrous and illegal. In 1971, Mrs. Ora Spitler McFarlane petitioned Judge Harold D. Stump of the DeKalb County, Indiana, Circuit Court to engage in a covert, compulsory sterilization of her 15-year-old daughter, Linda K. Spitler. Although Linda was promoted each year with her class, Mrs. McFarlane opined that she was somewhat retarded and had begun to stay out overnight with older youths, and we all know what that can lead to. Judge Stump quickly signed the order, and the judge and Mama hustled Linda into a hospital, telling her it was for an appendicitis operation. Linda was then sterilized without her knowledge. 2 years later, Linda married a Leo Sparkman and discovered that she had been sterilized without her knowledge. The Sparkmans proceeded to sue Mama, Mama's attorney, the doctor, the hospital, and Judge Stump, alleging a half dozen constitutional violations. All of these people, in truth, had grossly violated Linda's rights and aggressed against her. All should have been made to pay and pay dearly for their monstrous offense. But the federal district court ruled otherwise. First, it ruled that Mama, her lawyer, and the various members of the healing professions were all immune because everything they had done received the sanction of a certified judge. And second, Judge Stump was also absolutely immune because he had acted in his capacity as a judge, even though the district court acknowledged he had had an erroneous view of the law. So not only is a judge immune, but he can confer his immunity in a king-like fashion even onto lowly civilians who surround him. The U.S. Court of Appeals, Seventh Circuit, unaccountably didn't understand the program, and so it reversed the district court, claiming that Judge Stump has forfeited his immunity because of his failure to comply with elementary principles of due process, and had therefore, in a sense, not acted within his jurisdiction. To allow Stump's action to stand, said the appeals court, would be to sanction, quote, tyranny from the bench. Now, this was pretty flimsy stuff, and besides, it opened an entertaining wedge toward holding judges accountable to the law and to the protection of rights like everyone else. But this would have shaken the foundations of our monopoly-archist legal system. And so the U.S. Supreme Court on March 28th set the matter straight. In a 5-3 decision in this illuminating case of Stump versus Sparkman, Justice Byron R. White, speaking for the majority, sternly reminded the appellate court of the meaning of the 1872 ruling. A judge will not be deprived of immunity because the action he took was in error, was done maliciously, or was in excess of his authority. Rather, he will be subject to liability only when he has acted in the clear absence of all jurisdiction. Justice White conceded that no state law or court ruling anywhere could be said to have authorized Judge Stump's action, but the important point, he went on, is that there was no statute or ruling which prohibited such an action by the judge. Therefore, even though Stump had approved the sterilization order without legal authorization, without holding a hearing, without notice to the child, or without her being represented by a lawyer or guardian, it was still a judicial act and therefore beyond the law. Backing Justice White were Justices Warren Burger, Harry Blackmun, William Rehnquist, and John Stevens. For the minority, Justice Potter Stewart, joined by Lewis Powell and Thurgood Marshall, argued that the judge's unauthorized action was, quote, beyond the pale of anything that could sensibly be called a judicial act. He pointed out that Stump's action, quote, was in no way an act normally performed by a judge. Indeed, there is no reason to believe that such an act has ever been performed by any other Indiana judge before or since. In a ringing statement, Stewart concluded, quote, a judge is not free, like a loose cannon, to inflict indiscriminate damage whenever he announces that he is acting in his judicial capacity. Ah, Justice Stewart, but apparently and unfortunately, he is so free. Stump himself will be free for some time to come. Apparently, the masses of DeKalb County were not concerned about Linda's rights, for they reelected him last year to another 6-year term as circuit court judge. Bruce Ennis, legal director of the American Civil Liberties Union, charged that the White decision meant that, quote, judges can violate citizens' constitutional rights and get away with it, and can ignore the law with impunity. Ennis said that the ACLU would ask for legislation from Congress reversing this outrageous decision. Outrage, yes, but why the shock and surprise? White and his allies were, one, simply being thick as judges, guildsmen defending their guild privileges, and, two, were defending the very cornerstone of our archist system, the immunity from the law of the ultimate decision makers. Removing such immunity strikes at the very heart of that system and paves the way for a truly free America, in which rights would be protected fully, in which no man or group of men would be above the law, or would have a compulsory monopoly of judicial services, We hail Mr. Ennis and the minority judges, but do they know the full implications when we pit citizens' rights against the loose canon of judges and the tyranny of the bench? That article is by Murray N. Rothbard. It's called The Tyranny of the Bench, and you can find it online at lourockwell.com. So here we just listened to a story where we had a woman's preferences being overridden by her mother and by the court system and being imposed on her against her will, without her knowledge, and against her preferences. She had a preference to have children, and even so, she waited only a couple of years, got married, tried to have children, found out that her preferences had been overruled by a court sentence. So the takeaway that I get from this and from learning about libertarianism is that my preferences matter and that I shouldn't suppress my own preferences, that I shouldn't allow other people to suppress my preferences, and I certainly shouldn't allow people to overrule my preferences and cause me to behave in a way that is completely against my preferences, especially under threat of the initiation of force and kidnapping and attack and all of the stuff that people do in society to control other people's behavior. So my takeaway from this and from libertarianism in general is that my preferences matter and that my voice can and could be heard by myself and by others, and that my preferences are just as important as any other person's preferences. So I just try to listen to myself and honor my preferences because, you know, there's so many people who want to shut down your preferences, from the government to other people in your life to even ourself when we exercise the tyranny of the self over our own preferences. And so, you know, when I have a preference, I really try to listen to myself and try to think about what it is that I would like, given the environment that I'm in and given all the other things that I could possibly do with the scarce amount of time that I have left on this planet. So thank you so much for listening to the show. This has been an episode of The Austrian Circle. You can find us online at whus.org and also on Facebook. I also have a YouTube channel. You can find me, just do a search for Austrian Circle for all or some of the past shows that I've done. And I hope that you'll tune in next week. Have a great week. Take care.